Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here, Humanist of the Year, 2010. And I'm doing now exactly what you're doing. I'm listening to the Humanist Hour. Just turn it up loud.
Facts, why I'm here. Cause I am a sound scientist. Came to evaluate the evidence. On a closed case, highly classified, confidential.
It's August 25th, and you're listening to the Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your guest host, Jennifer Barty.
So listeners, you heard it for yourselves. Bill Nye introduced our new name, the Humanist Hour.
I like it. I like it a lot, Jess.
Yeah, I like it too.
And you know, we're really going to try to stick to that hour.
Yes, we are. Because you know, humanists, we're known for things like details and punctuality and time.
Precision.
Yeah.
Chronology.
That's more what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Humanist Hour-ish wasn't available as a domain name, so.
Right.
So, Jennifer, I mean, take a look around. Tell me what you see. Where are we?
Yeah, good question. Where are we?
I mean, so far, I just want to mention on the show, I've been accused of, like, pulling random people off the street into my black SUV and, like, bringing them to force them to co-host with me. Now, you know, Jennifer's like, where am I?
Right. I wasn't blindfolded. I mean, no. I came willingly because, well, listeners, we're in a castle.
Yep.
And it looks like a castle from outside. It's got ivy climbing the walls and it's got turrets and big stone entryway.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Jennifer, rumor has it that the turret is also the home to an invisible inhabitant.
A ghost.
That's what I'm saying. Rumor has it. I mean, you know, we're humanists, right? We're skeptic. Believe things that we can see.
Uh-huh. And hear. Because I'll tell you what, humanists are very skeptical. But listeners, we heard a noise. I mean, we're sort of in the upper reaches of this castle.
Yep.
And we heard a noise a little while ago. It went something like this.
That's exactly right. And just like hearing it again gives me goosebumps. Like, I'm a little freaked out right now. But, you know, anyway, maybe, you know, over the next hour or so, we'll hear it again.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the one thing that you definitely will hear over the next hour is some more content from the AHA 69th Annual Conference, which was held earlier this summer in San Jose, California. And we're saving, or we have saved, the sort of crescendo of that conference for this month, which is the 2010 Hottie.
The what?
You heard me. The Hottie.
The Hottie?
Yes.
Who's that?
It's the 2010 Humanist of the Year.
H-O-T. Ah, gotcha.
Got it? You with me now?
Bill Nye, the science guy.
That's right.
And I'm guessing, Jess, it's not the first time he's been called a hottie.
I'm sure you're right. That's awesome. So we're going to play Bill Nye's acceptance speech from receiving that Humanist of the Year award.
And we've got some nice, fun biographical facts about him, some trivia. But first, Jess, you caught up with him at the banquet and asked him a few pointed questions.
That's right. So let's play that clip first.
Bill Nye, thank you so much for being here. The first question I have for you is, do you actually consider yourself a humanist?
I'm reluctant to call myself an ist in any way, but I share so much with you all that after fashion, yes, I'm a humanist. Certainly, I believe in humans more than just about anything else.
Do you see religion playing a role in America's ability to become science literate?
If you tell people that their religion is inherently wrong, or especially it's inherently bad, you're not going to win them over, ever. In the same way, they're not going to win me over by telling me I'm a sinner, I'm a loser, I'm born a loser, and I don't deserve anything. So we have so much more in common than we have that's different. Humans are so much more alike than they are different. I just like to focus on that rather than the differences. So does religion have a role? If it gets people to come together and share ideas, then I guess yes, that would be a worthy thing.
Okay. And do you have any advice for the humanist movement for how we can help America become more science literate?
Be positive. Embrace people. Emphasize the things you have in common rather than the things that are different. Easy to say, hard to do.
All right. Bill Nye, thank you so much for speaking with the Humanist Hour.
It really is great to be here.
So, wow, Jess, it sounded like he was off in a hurry.
Yeah, well, I mean, you should have seen just the line of, you know, adoring fans who were getting pictures and autographs and stuff. I was pretty honored that he just took, you know, the couple minutes that he did to speak with me. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It was definitely a high point in my interview career.
Cool.
That's for sure. Yeah.
Cool.
Yep. So before we get into Bill Nye's acceptance speech of the Hottie, Humanist of the Year 2010, we're going to give you some little tidbits of his bio and also maybe some little bits of trivia, some things that you might not know about Bill Nye. But first, obviously, unless you've been living on the third floor of an otherwise uninhabited castle, or, you know, perhaps under a rock, Bill Nye is obviously rather popular for the Disney show Bill Nye the Science Guy, which ran from 1993 to 1997. And Bill followed that up with a PBS series, The Eye of Nye. Bill has since then had many gigs, both in academia and in entertainment, promoting science and science literacy. He's also known as an environmental activist and has most recently appeared on various TV news shows commenting on the BP oil spill.
And some random facts we did dig up. He was born in D.C., lives in L.A.
Yep. His father was a sundial manufacturer.
He studied mechanical engineering at Cornell. One of his professors was Carl Sagan, who was the Humanist of the Year, the Hottie, in 1981.
Bill holds several United States patents, including ballet shoes.
I love that.
Yeah, naturally, right?
Bill Nye began his professional entertainment career as an actor on a sketch comedy television show in Seattle called Almost Live. And I think you'll see that his comedic chops are still very much intact when you hear his remarks, Jeff.
Absolutely.
But one of his recurring roles on that show was as Speedwalker, a speedwalking Seattle superhero.
I can totally see that.
And when the host of the show at one point pronounced gigawatt as gigawatt, Nye tried to correct the mistake, which prompted the host to say, "Who do you think you are? Bill Nye, the science guy," which gave birth to his persona.
That's pretty awesome. I love that story.
Yeah.
All right, Jennifer, why don't you tell the listeners what's up next?
Well, introducing Bill Nye and presenting him with the award was Jennifer Kalmanson, who is a NASA scientist and a very active humanist celebrant, and so on. And she gives a really nice introduction. And it brings up her introduction, which you're about to hear, brings up an interesting point, I think, Jess, about the rationale behind the selection of the Humanist of the Year.
Right.
This is an award that was established in 1953. It's been given out every year since to recognize a person of national or international reputation who, through the application of humanist values, has made a significant contribution to the improvement of the human condition. So typically, the Humanist of the Year isn't being honored for his or her work in the previous year, as with, say, Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Instead, the Humanist of the Year is someone whose career and contributions to society are being lauded at the same time that their humanist credentials are being really brought to the fore. These folks aren't known as humanists per se, and they often resist identifying themselves as such, even after accepting the award,
right,
as you heard Bill Nye do. But the point is that they're ambassadors of humanism, and you're going to hear that in Jennifer's remarks. They're popular figures in science, politics, business, philosophy, the arts, and so on. Did you know that Ted Turner was Humanist of the Year?
I did not.
Alice Walker, R. Buckminster Fuller, Joyce Carol Oates. Apparently, Turner was one of those who flew in, accepted the award, and promptly left the conference. Others, like Asimov, Vonnegut, and the 2009 Humanist of the Year, P.Z. Myers, hung around all weekend. Incidentally, Vonnegut's acceptance speech was titled, "Why My Dog Is Not a Humanist." So when A.J. card-carrying humanists wonder why we don't bestow the Hottie Award on, quote, real humanists who've been involved with the movement for years and really are deserving, we have to explain this idea of ambassadorship by the famous. Bill Nye didn't shy away from it and from the award. And as you'll hear, he embraced the organization, its members, and its values quite demonstrably.
So without further ado, here's that presentation of the 2010 Humanist of the Year Award to Bill Nye, the science guy.
I'd like to begin with a quote, because this is one of those things that breaks the ice. Albert Einstein, one of the folks mentioned by David Naosi, once said, "It can scarcely be denied that the supreme goal of all theory is to make the irreducible basic elements as simple and as few as possible without having to surrender the adequate representation of a single datum of experience." Translated into the vernacular, that quote reads, "Everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler." It is this skill of translating science into the vernacular of our culture and for simplifying scientific concepts to their essential kernels without distorting the nuance of their underlying principles, which brought Bill Nye to fame as Bill Nye the Science Guy. It is, however, his transcendence of his role as Bill Nye the Science Guy into an activist for solid scientific foundations in our policies regarding sustainable society, which brings him before us today as the 2010 Humanist of the Year. Too often, it is easy in the world of science and engineering, I speak from personal experience, to hide behind the cut and dried facts of how things work and even why things work without venturing forth into the relatively risky arena of convincing others around yourself that these scientific facts ought to guide our decision making regarding matters on which they directly shed light. Moving from a neutral technical authority to an activist role can be hazardous to careers and personal relationships alike. And so many of us choose to hide behind our veneer of professional distance rather than candidly express our views, even on topics about which we may have direct expertise. Bill Nye has stepped into the public eye as a vocal activist for responsible, sustainable living practices, as well as for how our limited resources for planetary exploration ought to be spent. He has educated our youth, demystifying every cool subject from dinosaurs to quicksand to tarantulas, and now, through his Stuff Happens show, informing that same cohort about how to make consumer choices that will do the least harm. Bill Nye's 90s show, Bill Nye the Science Guy, told us how the world worked. His show, Stuff Happens, it applies that knowledge to encourage us to make better choices in our lives. He has made the leap from science to ethics, a rare thing in a world in which we still hear, even many of us in this room, demur that science has no bearing on ethics. It's time we take a stand. We all know that science can inform our ethical choices. We know from evolutionary biology that we evolved to be moral animals. And we know from our nascent climate sciences that we moral animals had better start making better choices, or we will overconsume ourselves into extinction. It's time to say these things out loud, as Bill Nye did. A good example of this, in a great pun on the keeping up with the Joneses mentality, which drives so very much of this consumption in our culture, Bill Nye has even vowed to crush his neighbor Ed Begley in a contest to see who can achieve the smallest carbon footprint. So far, my money's on Bill Nye. I'd also like to touch on a theme that Rob Boston mentioned yesterday in his talk. We, all of us, are ambassadors for humanism. Like it or not, the outside world judges our movement collectively by what they see in us, each of us, whether we are open about our beliefs or not. Every day, we make choices, choices about what to say and how to say it, choices about where we draw the line between communication about our own beliefs versus antagonistic baiting of the beliefs of others. We navigate the treacherous waters between the Scylla of inaction, of silent complicity, and the Charybdis of alienating our potential allies in efforts to make the world better for all of us. The tone of what Bill Nye communicates, whether through his blog, his television shows, or his greening competition with Ed Begley, remains always true to the course of speaking up without crossing the line into deliberate provocation. His material is as wholesome as it is truthful and provides a resource for all of us to build a bridge with others. Sometimes we can't talk directly about our naturalistic worldview, but everyone's heard of Bill Nye the Science Guy. If you're young enough, chances are you've even watched Bill Nye the Science Guy in science class when you were growing up. I hear some woos out there, so I know this is true. No matter how distorted the worldviews of the person you're talking to, that person will not only know who Bill Nye is, but will most likely have a favorable memory associated with his work. Bill Nye then becomes the first foundation for a bridge across the chasm of differing worldviews. If you can't talk about evolution, you can always talk about quicksand or tarantulas or optical illusions. And the next thing you know, the person you're talking with is willing to consider the notion that he or she has much more in common with you than different from you. And we all know that easily, sort of, that sort of thinking. Got to watch that, because it can lead to tolerance and enlightened thinking. All the sorts of things that people we're trying to convince to humanism often resist. So without any further ado, and without embarrassing poor Bill Nye any further, it is my humble honor and privilege to present you a man whose teachings about the natural world can teach us also so much more about communicating our message in a forthright and effective way. Please welcome Bill Nye.
Thank you. My goodness, young woman. Wow. Thank you very much, Jennifer. Thank you. Wow, what an introduction. I better not blow it. I was very excited. Thank you, first of all, thank you very much for this award. This it's physically beautiful, but of course it's spiritually... Can I say spiritually here? Makes you feel good. I was very excited to do this talk tonight until just a few minutes ago. Someone came up to me and said, "Is Bill Nye your real name?" And I said, "It's William Nye." And that, everything was going fine. Right? And, but then he said, "Why did you change it?" I didn't really change it. Many years ago, you guys probably know this guy. He's a respected science writer. Do you guys know K-E-A-Y? Do you know him? Key Davidson? Anyway, for a few minutes, is he here? He was publishing a thing, Key Davidson, the science guy. And my attorney wrote him a letter in this net. Anyway, I ended up talking to the guy on the phone. And I said, "Besides, Mr. Davidson, Key Davidson, the science guy, doesn't rhyme." "What do you mean?" I said, "The Bill Nye, the science guy." "Oh, that's really good. Oh, that's great." And this gets into the thing of critical thinking skills and questioning things. So as a young man, this was presented to me as a true story. And I don't know if this is a true story. But it certainly has made an impression on me. My grandfather was in the Rotary. I'm sure he would have been in the humanists if known it existed 100 years ago. But they had a convention in Philadelphia. In my understanding, it was in Philadelphia on purpose. More power to you, that's all. But he didn't. Even in those days, you rented a tuxedo, and he didn't know how to tie the bow tie. So he just went to the hotel room next door, just went down the hall, just knocked on the door, "Excuse me, can you help me tie this tie?" The guy said, "Yeah, sure, lie down on the bed." So the story goes, my grandfather lay on the bed, and the guy tied a perfect knot, perfect bow tie knot. It's great. Then my grandfather, questioning, skeptic, and so on. "Thank you. Why'd I have to lie down on the bed? I'm an undertaker." That's the only way. Now, even if it's not a true story, it's a good story. It's a good joke. And I mention this because this is something I want you all, I want us all to think about. First of all, thank you again for the award. It's great. But I want you to think, we all have a tendency in skepticism, critical thinking, to a degree in science education, to find ourselves, dare I say it, preaching to the choir. Is that, did I lose you with that reference? It's a in church they have a preacher, and sometimes I know many of you have never seen this, but they have that. Anyway, it is presumed that a passive voice being employed for comedic effect in this instance. It is presumed that we think that the choir would already be converted, but you don't really know that. The choir might just be there singing because they like to sing. But it is to be hoped that they'll go along. So let's say that we have great success in preaching to the choir, and it makes you feel good to preach to the choir, but we have to do more. We have to reach out. And Jennifer, your remarks were so, prescient. They were so, I was going to say that. I really appreciate it. Because if we don't, we will lose ground. And I say we. I'm talking about people who embrace science. Because if you like to worry about things, you are living at a great time. I mean, we all like to worry about things. You know, you have the smooth part of the road is just not nearly as important as the bumps. The bumps are what you have to keep track of. I don't know if you've ever ridden a bicycle, no hands, but you'll discover this sooner or later. Or if you're, let's say, you're texting while you're driving, you might find the same thing. I'm sure none of you have ever done that. But anyway, the deal is we have to reach out to people, and leading by way of example is certainly the best thing you can do. The trouble we have now, you know, we live in the United States. Or I met somebody from Canada. How many people are not from the U.S. here? Where are you all from? Canada? Guatemala, yeah. Where are you from? Romania. Welcome. That's great. Romania. Let's hear it for Romania. Let's hear it for Guatemala. No, it's good. But in the United States, we have this unique situation where we have sort of nominally the most technically advanced society in the world. I mean, you can get into fistfights in the space exploration bar about this, but the United States still has a very large technological lead in many things, and yet we have this wacky, very influential sector of society that doesn't believe in evolution. And for me, this is very, of course, as a science educator, very troubling. I know this is not news to you, choir members. But how to solve this problem is going to take a long time. And I believe that the way to do it is by coming up with stories. People respond to stories. People respond to beginning, middle, and end that involve a hero who's got some trouble, and then he resolves it, and so on. There was my grandfather. Couldn't tie his tie. What was going to happen? Oh, my goodness, you're going to show up with the open collar. You know, not in the 1900s, in the aughts, you wouldn't do that. Now, of course, you know, people in Hollywood, they don't wear tuxedos, these kids today, when I was young. So what we got to do is come up with stories that explain why we believe what we believe, and, or if you will, don't believe in what we don't believe. And the example right now, I remember very well being, oh, by the way, I was brought up in the Episcopal Church, and I related this joke earlier to a young journalist, and this just shows you what's happening to the world. Somebody referenced me as being Sagan-esque. Yes, thank you. That was very nice. But there are many people who don't know who Carl Sagan was. How many people don't know who Carl Sagan was? Yeah, see, there you go. So, no, it's these kids today. But this, I mean, of course, it's very flattering. Unlike many of us, Carl Sagan won a Pulitzer Prize for a book about evolution. That's hard to do, I think, because not everybody really believes in it. But I remember very well as a kid being troubled by the joke. Wherever there are four Episcopalians, there's a fifth. And you see, this young woman is looking at me like, what? If I had simply said, there's a 750 millilitereth, then it would have been hilarious. Yeah. Just there was a time when booze was sold by the fifth of a gallon for some reason. I guess they started with 10, and a tenth just seemed too small, man. That's now we gotta double that. Yeah. So anyway, I was brought up in the Episcopal Church, and I was very unsatisfied. I used to be one of the speakers. I would get up in front of the microphone in the pulpit. I don't know if you've ever seen that. They have it in church, a pulpit. And I would read from this big, thick book that was in arcane English. And I liked that part. But the rest of it sort of didn't make any sense. And it's very much analogous for me to the ancient dinosaurs. I am so old, young woman. How old are you? I'm so old. I remember when there wasn't really any satisfactory explanation for the disappearance of the ancient dinosaurs. Well, their brains were too small and they were like stupid. And so like other animals ate them. Really, if you're a Tyrannosaurus Rex, you're going to kick some butt. I mean, you know, it's like you don't really need to worry about the small things, do you? I mean, except, of course, diseases, parasites. So, no, that's what will get you. Lions and tigers and bears they're troublesome. Believe me, they are troublesome. But diseases and parasites, that's what will take you out. Now, trust me on that. You can try it. So, it's hilarious. Malaria joke. Yeah. No, it's hilarious. Acquired immune deficiency. So, anyway, was very troubled by the lack of explanation for the ancient dinosaurs. And it was quite a revelation when people discovered this meteorite, this crater in Belize. If it's not the whole story, it's a pretty good story. And then I was alive when the layer of iridium was discovered around the world or associated with this meteoric empire, multiple object impact. And this sort of resolved a huge problem. And I am so old, I remember when it was really still kind of a wacky theory that Africa would fit into South America in some fashion. It was still considered a little out there, even though the fossil evidence was pretty compelling, and the stratigraphy, the layers of geological deposits were very well associated. But now, plate tectonics is the underlying idea in all of geology. Now it all fits together, and everybody's, oh, yes, of course, silly us, yes. And so I often wonder what else it is that we're just completely missing that will integrate all sorts of our current scientific ideas. And you don't have to know the whole answer right now. The joy, the PB&J, the passion, beauty, and joy, is in the pursuit of this, right? That's what we love about science. It is absolutely, to me, the best idea humans have ever had. Science. And I can even say science is the best idea we've had so far. Could change, right? Bring it on. You got a better idea, bring it on. The big unsatisfying thing for me is when you have a bumper sticker that says, God said it, I believe it, and that settles it. It doesn't settle it for me. And I was in Texas a couple years ago. It still circulates on the web. At McLennan University. It's a very interesting college there near Waco, near Crawford. And, yeah. No, I don't know if you've ever been to Crawford, Texas. It's just another zip code. It is Waco. I mean, it's all one thing, for better or for worse. And I said, well, it seems reasonable to me that whoever wrote Genesis there, as translated into English, where God made the sun to light the earth and the moon to light the night, probably didn't have the whole story. Probably. Because the moon, first of all, the moon doesn't always light the night. It's clear. I can tell the difference, sun, moon. I mean, I'm there. I can see. And then even ancient Greeks realized that the moon was an object that reflected sunlight. So this woman picked her kids up by the wrists and dragged them out of the room. I believe in God. Bill Nye, you are evil. That may be. But the moon doesn't give off its own light. I'm sorry. It's just, there's nothing I can do there. And we all laugh at that. You know, as I say, I'm preaching to the choir. But what we have to do is find a story that is more compelling. And I think we can find that easily, because instead of focusing on the truth, we focus on the pursuit of it. We focus on the scientific method, the way to find the truth. And it's those stories that I find so compelling and so important. And by the way, when you were in astronomy class with Carl Sagan, every day there was a story. Every day there was some process by which somebody or some group of individuals had made a discovery. And Jennifer made reference to my involvement in planetary exploration. I'm a member of the Planetary Society. I'm vice president of the Planetary Society. I'm on the board of the Planetary Society, which is something that happens when you leave the room. I don't know if you've ever you come back. Hey, Bill, you're vice president. Oh, whoa, okay, that's great. Great news. But the thing that's so wonderful about when you see a picture from Mars, which are now routine, soon Japanese spacecraft is going to take new and very exciting pictures of Venus. I hope everyone here is alive in 2015 when we bring back the first pictures of Pluto. So this is not a discovery made by an individual. This is a discovery made by a society, that people thought this was a worthy pursuit. And then quite often people say, a very reasonable question, well, how can you be exploring space when there's so much to do here on Earth? Well, my friends, think how the world would be if we thought the moon gave off its own light, if we thought the Earth were the center of the solar system, if we thought that the Earth were the only planet that had moons, had a satellite. How would the world be if we didn't have that picture from space from Apollo 17? How would it be if we didn't have a global positioning system? How would it be if we didn't have the internet? By the stars, you can't be serious. Yes, there was a time. Yes. There was a time in the distant past. And it is through this, by the way, that we have made, to me, the most important discovery facing humankind. As I said a few minutes ago, if you like to worry about things, this is it for you. We've got the economy, we've got human immunodeficiency virus, we've got people who are going to acquire nuclear material who aren't familiar with the great traditions of treaties and stuff. But what we really have, if you like to worry, is we have climate change. Climate change is going to change the world in ways that are literally hard to imagine. And it is this hard-to-imagine nature of them that is costing us so dearly in time. We're losing valuable time because of this disbelief in the scientific method. I mean, as I say to climate skeptics, if you don't believe in climate change, why? Why don't you believe in it? And as near as I can tell, it's mostly people who grew up in wide open spaces. People who grew up when there are a lot fewer people in the world. I remember back in 1965, my family took me to the World's Fair in New York City. Yes, there were people alive in 1965. It's hard to believe, but yes. And we had just missed, my father was the guy that would pull the car over to take pictures of the odometer to watch it go from 99,000 to 100,000, you know. Pulling the driver on the side of the road, the police are going, what are you doing, sir? We're just, okay, that's very good. Anyway, we got there right after this very large board, tote board, had changed from 3 billion from 2,999,999,999 people in the world to 3 billion. When we got there, it was 3,700,000 and something. I claim I remember it pretty well. Well, that was in 1965. Now we're about 6.8 billion. By the end of next year, we'll be at 6.9 billion. And that's really the problem, that having that many people living on what's proving to be a very small planet is really going to be troublesome. And the trouble that we're discovering associated with climate change comes from space exploration. By comparing the climate of Mars with the Earth, and then comparing the climate of Venus with the Earth, and then especially if you like to party, comparing the climate of Mercury with Venus, that's nothing but fun. Venus considerably hotter than Mercury, even though it's almost twice as far from the sun. For you inverse square law buffs, that should be a quarter as hot, but it's quite a bit hotter. It's so hot on Venus. It's so hot on Venus you could melt lead. It's so hot on Venus that all the oxygen's been cooked away, all the water vapor's been cooked away, and they, if there are any of them, have sulfuric acid rain, which I got to think. I mean, we got surface melting lead and sulfuric acid rain. That's tough. And I hope you all remember this game where you can't step on the floor because it's like lava. And then you got to like go from one side of the kitchen to the other on the chairs because the sink is like acid. Well, on Venus, it's really like that. I mean, it's like, and the wooden chairs, I know in the kitchen, there's some issues. It's a game, right? By any sort of Western culture reckoning, Venus really is like hell. And so if we keep things up the way they are, we very well may be headed to that. So I'll just leave you with one more thought that I find so compelling. It is through science, the discovery of this process, that I came to be a skeptic, and I came to really embrace critical thinking, and I came to embrace the idea that you probably only get one shot at life. And so... roughly, don't blow it. I think about this also often. You know, if you live to be 82 and 7 weeks, anyone here? 82 and 7 weeks. It depends on leap years. But 82 and some change, you get to go through your 30,000th day. 30,000 days. And when you're young, when you're in elementary school and stuff, 30,000 is uncountable. You can't imagine that many days. But if you go to the Colosseum when the seats are all used, when the tarps are rolled back, and you get to sit in a different seat every day, you won't get halfway around. Now, I'm willing to admit that 102A is probably real similar to 103A, but still, you're not even going to get halfway around. And so that's why we really have to take advantage of every day, and we have to present our arguments that the scientific method and the process of science really is the best idea we've ever had to as many people as possible. But we have a tendency, all of us, to dismiss people who believe other things, to dismiss people from outside, to dismiss people that speak different languages. But I remember as a kid standing on the beach. This is in this story, I was in Delaware, which is a state back east, for those of you in Californians. The first state, the Diamond State. They haven't found any minerals there. They just thought it was looks kind of cool. It's at sunrise. The waves have little diamonds in them, apparently. I stood there, and I remember our third grade teacher, Mrs. Cochran, had told us that there are more stars in the sky than grains of sand on the beach. And I remember thinking, I didn't articulate it in this way. I remember thinking at the time, Mrs. Cochran, are you high? I had some other way of saying it, but Mrs. Cochran, there's a lot of sand on the beach. Lady, I mean, if you stand in Delaware, it's 1,500 nautical miles in each direction. There's nothing but sand. Sand. When you dig down, you shuffle your feet, there's more sand. When the tide goes out, there is sand. You look behind you, there is sand. It's a sand festival. Sand, sand, sand. Mrs. Cochran, there can't possibly... Yes, there are more stars than all of that. And it doesn't take you long to stand there and think, look, I really am not that different from a grain of sand. I mean, I am insignificant. I mean, if you look out at the so-called trackless ocean, if you go out there even a few nautical miles, you disappear. You have no idea where you are. Am I near Delaware? Am I near Papua New Guinea? You can't really tell unless you're very experienced. You look at the sea color. At night, you don't really know. So I remember thinking, I am just another speck of sand. And the Earth, really, in the cosmic scheme of things, is another speck. And the sun, an unremarkable star. Nothing special about the sun. The sun is another speck. And the galaxy is a speck. I'm a speck on a speck, orbiting a speck, among other specks, among still other specks, in the middle of specklessness. I suck. But then, my friends, with my brain, which is only this big, and if you ever met him, my old boss, even it must have been quite a bit smaller. But even he, we can imagine all of this. And it's with our brains that we can know our place in the universe. We can know our place in space. And that does not suck. That is worthy of respect. That is what's so great. That is what's so wonderful about humans. Thank you all very much. Thank you for this award. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. On a pillowcase, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Well, Jess, he did not blow it.
No, he didn't. He nailed that. That was awesome.
Mm-hmm. And I think he was the perfect choice for Humanist of the Year because his comedic background really came through, but also his passion, his scientific knowledge.
Right.
It was the whole combination.
I agree. And I see a lot of similarities in the way that Neil deGrasse Tyson gave his. It wasn't a talk. It was just an acceptance speech.
But equally, just so entertaining.
Yep.
And they're friends, right?
Yeah, they are. They are. And I think both of them speak to the whole idea of finding a more compelling story, which was one of the things that I really liked about Bill Nye's talk. Just talking about, something that people can identify with in making a story and having a character and having them be on some sort of quest for some sort of truth in a struggle, because everyone has that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also to have some resolution within that smaller story.
Yeah.
I love the joke he told about his grandfather having his bow tie tied lying on the bed.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Oh, man. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed it as much as we did.
So if you folks want to keep up with what Bill Nye is doing in the world with science today, you should check out his website, which is billnye.com, BILLNYE.com.
And that's not all, Jess. The next podcast is going to feature the Q&A session that followed Bill Nye's acceptance speech. And this is where things get a little wild.
And it's just, your hands and feet go shooting like this. The oxygen mask pulls off your face. Oh, it's so cool. It's so cool.
Oh, wow. I may have to come back for that one, Jess.
You know, I hope that you do. And I also just want to thank you for coming again this month and just helping us to actually officially announce our new name, the Humanist Hour.
Yeah, I'm excited. And actually, it is accessible now from the Humanist website, the Humanist magazine website at thehumanist.org.
That's right. Right on that homepage, you'll see a little podcast player down toward the bottom left-hand corner of the page. You can listen to all the previous episodes there, and there's going to be a link to the show notes for this episode. So all of it right there, thehumanist.org. That's awesome. Well, folks, thanks for listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your co-host, Jennifer Bardi, signing off from the castle. Thank you.